Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Neil Jordan, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, Neil, people mainly think of you as a film director, but of course you started as a novelist and your 10th novel is out, The Well of St. Nobody. And we're going to talk about that, but you're also going to be a guinea pig for a little occasional summer series we're doing where you pick some songs that have meant something to you over your life. Before we do all that, Sinead O'Connor was a friend and a collaborator of yours. And look, a lot has been said. I was interested that you met her recently and she was in good form.
She was in great form. She really was, yeah. She had rented a little house in Dalkey and she was sharing it with a friend of mine, Drajan, who's a guitarist, and she just seemed great. She was smoking, as usual, you know. She was... and then suddenly she vanished and she went to London. And she went to Brixton and she sent me a few texts saying... I had to get out of Darland, she called it.
Yeah.
This Darland that loves her so much now.
I know,
come on.
But she used to talk about people here having a Nyland mentality and being so Georgie, yeah.
Anyway, she, and then obviously something tragic happened, so that's it.
Do you think, is there a lot of cant now being talked?
I think Ireland needs saints. It's got this desperate need for saints, you know.
Yeah.
And some part of me thinks the country has not changed a bit, you know. So now poor Sinead has given them a saint, you know. That's all I've got to say about it, Brendan.
Yeah.
Do you mind?
No, not at all.
Thank you very much.
Not at all.
Okay.
I think you've said a lot.
Okay.
Okay. Music. So your first song that you're going to choose today is a Frank Zappa number. And I must admit, Frank Zappa is a gap in my musical education, but I'm vaguely aware of him. He's a far out character. He was a friend of yours.
Well, I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles and he was one of the few people I could relate to when I was there. I swear to God, it's bizarre. You know, I was introduced to him by my girlfriend at the time. And I used to go out to his house. And if you don't know who Frank Zappa is, like, you're younger than me, let's put it that way. Yeah, you know, he had this huge, enormous thing of hair. He had this goatee beard, looked like something, some mad kind of figure from the 16th century. He was a musical genius and I loved him dearly. And he was the kind of culture had passed him by a little bit, you know, by the time I met him. I actually was with him when he found out he had cancer, you know. He never used to take a drug or drink or anything like that, but he used to smoke it constantly, you know. And he ran this amazing campaign for freedom in the record business, you know.
Yeah.
For which all of the conservatives, and even the wife of the president at the time,
so
I
this
think,
was
hated
the Tipper Gore time.
Tipper Gore time, yeah. Yeah. And then Vaclav Havel became the... president of Czechoslovakia, and Vaclav Havel appointed Frank as the economic advisor to the Czech Republic. I swear to God, yeah. And when Havel was invited to the White House by Ronald Reagan, Frank turns up, you know, dressed in a monkey suit and all that sort of stuff, and he says, I want to go and be at the table with the president and the premier of the new state of Czechoslovakia, and they wouldn't let him in. So he was that kind of guy, you know.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. It's gas that... So you went to L.A. and the only normal person you could find to hang out with was Frank Zappa.
Well, he was the most intelligent person around, really. I just kind of fell into his orbit by accident, but I really enjoyed it, you know, and he used to go up there a lot.
Okay, so we're going to play a bit of this and look...
sung by Captain Beefheart, I believe. I believe the voice is Captain Beefheart on this as well.
Really, yeah?
I think so, yeah, but you could check me on that.
Okay, so this is Frank Zappa and this is called Willie the Pimp.
Standing on the porch of the Lido Hotel, bruising in the lobby, love the way I sell my feet, my back, my ass, my hips. Oh,
could go into a kind of a trance listening to that all day, couldn't
you? That's him playing the guitar. Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's Willie the Pimp, Frank Zappa. I think I can safely say that's the only Frank Zappa you'll probably hear on Radio 1 today. Interesting, Cillian Murphy, who played Kitten in Breakfast in Pluto, he named his band the Sons of Mr. Green Jeans. He had a kind of acid jazz band when he was in college. They had a potential of a deal with acid jazz, named after a Zappa song as well. But I gather Cillian Murphy was key to getting Breakfast in Pluto made, was he?
Not really. No. He wasn't key to getting it made. He was the person who wore me down with this determination to play
that
role.
That's key. Yeah.
You know, I was a bit. I was in two minds about it because I'd made The Crying Game. You know.
Yeah.
And I didn't know when Pat McKay wrote the novel whether he was influenced by that or not, but I wasn't sure I wanted to deal with the same issues again. And I did a little test with Cillian, and he was extraordinary. And then tried to forget about it, but he wouldn't let me forget about it. He kept saying, when are we doing this thing? When are we doing this movie? We have to do this film. So eventually it happened, you know, and he gave this extraordinary performance. He really did. I loved it. I loved going through the entire period of the 70s and the 80s, the late 70s and 80s and all that awful, confusing time, you know, when there was a bombing campaign in Britain, and there was the full flow of the IRA campaign up in the north of Ireland, and these characters, these innocents wandering through it, really. I loved making it, and I loved kind of commenting on that whole period. But Cillian was the centre of it.
And little you imagine, I'd say, that he would save cinema then as part of the Barbenheimer cinematic industrial complex last weekend there. Have you seen Oppenheimer?
Yeah, I've seen it. I saw it. Yeah, it's beautiful. Extraordinary film. And beautifully simple. But, I mean, finally, I think what happens to beautiful English and Irish actors, European actors, they all end up with, I would call it the Peter Lorre curse, you know. They end up being cast in slightly kind of dingy, villainous roles, you know. And with Oppenheimer, Cillian has finally broken free of that. So I'm thrilled for him. It's an amazing performance, you know, it really is.
Have you seen Barbie?
No, I will. I know I have to. I'll see it.
Okay, so we go from Frank Zappa to George Harrison. And George Harrison, an important figure in your career.
Well, I'd made a movie called Angel. I made a movie called The Company of Wolves, which is a wild thing. And then I wrote a movie called Mona Lisa. And it was being produced by Stephen Woolley, who was the producer of The Company of Wolves. And Handmade Films got involved as a financiers, you know. And that's how, at the time...
This is George Harrison.
George Harrison
company.
Set up Handmade Films basically to release Life of Brian, because I think the Hollywood company had deemed it too troublesome to release. So George... And George, I think Terry Gilliam persuaded George to set up to release it. So George set up this company called Handmade Films, which then got involved in film production. And I was doing this rather wonderful thing with Bob Hoskins. I mean, he's a rather wonderful actor. And I was going on this journey, and George was the financier, basically. And he said to me, look, I love this script. The only thing I don't want to see any sex stuff in it, you know. So I said, OK, that's surprising, but it's fine. Notice, you know, and one of the first scenes we did was in a spa, yeah, where Bob Hoskins had to dive underwater and follow Michael Caine through this spa, and of course he had to take his clothes off, and we had an underwater camera, you know, and it was a splash camera, you don't know what you're seeing through this camera, so the cameraman had the thing down there, and Bob dives in, and I'm watching the dailies with George Harrison, and all we can see are what the Irish call Mickeys, you know, nothing but that. I said, sorry, George, sorry. But he was a wonderful guy, wonderful.
And he was fairly hands-on.
He was more like a generous mentor, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he was lovely to hang out with, you know. At the time, he had a place in Henley, and he had an island somewhere close to Tahiti or somewhere like that, yeah. And he was a keen gardener, you know, so he'd plant a courgette in his garden in Henley, and he'd plant the same courgette in his volcanic island, and he compared the difference, and he was a rather wonderful figure, yeah, rather wonderful.
Okay, here's George Harrison and Give Me Love. That's George Harrison and Give Me Love. Now, the next song you've picked is a piece of classical music, but it does bring us to the novel you've just written, The Well of St. Nobody. It's kind of wild and savage in one way, and then in another way, it's a beautiful kind of a West Cork book. Tell us about it.
It's about two pianists, yeah? Two classical pianists, yeah. It's about a classical, you know, a rather august, austere classical pianist who met a student three times in his life. One is English, the other is Irish. And she remembered everything about their meetings and he remembers nothing, yeah. So it's about that irony where somebody can have a huge effect on somebody else and somebody else can think they've met three or four different people over a series of encounters. It's also about people who are kind of on the other end of middle age, you know? And I really felt like writing a book about, you know, about people in their 60s who have still the possibility of a romance in their lives, you know?
Yeah.
Still the possibility of a sexual relationship. I also wanted to write a book about music, you know? And I wanted to write a book about West Cork as well, that landscape, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what struck me reading it was you've written an amazing part for Jeremy Irons there. And he won't even have to travel far from the Pink Castle to show up for...
Maybe. Yeah. We'll see what happens, yeah.
You're drawn back again in it too. You see, on one hand, right, it's this really nice kind of summer read. And on the other hand, there's all these kind of naughty ghosts and shadows and different things. But you're drawn back again to, I don't know, would you call it kind of magic realism or rummaging around in the kind of collective unconscious. And funny you said about Sinead, Ireland needs saints.
Mm.
One of the themes here is myth and legend, yeah, and the need we have for it, is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, she basically, the story is she becomes his housekeeper and she's... He still doesn't recognise who she is, and he's walking out in the garden one day and the ground collapses beneath him. There's a well under there. And she, to tease him and to kind of punish him in a way, invents a selection of stories about this well. And when I was studying, I studied early Irish history in UCD, and it's a bizarre thing, but I did a thesis actually on early Irish hagiography, you know, which is a strange subject, but... It fascinated me.
Hagiography meaning,
you know, the very first lives of saints written in early Latin and medieval Irish, you know. And what fascinated me was there were so many pagan kind of, they were barely Christian at all, you know. There was a slightly Christian kind of troweling on of a sense of belief, but underneath there was this kind of utter Celtic pagan madness, you know, and that's what I was touching at, and that's what I was exploring in the novel, really. And I, you know, I'd call it more like a bizarre warped fairy tale than a piece of magic realism in a way. Do you understand what I mean? But I mean that is there in the Irish landscape. It always has been, you know.
Yeah,
and you're
drawn back to that kind of the subconscious and those pictures and those images and those archetypes that we all have and those saints we need and everything, are they actually far more powerful than we tend to let on in our day-to-day civilised lives, yeah?
Well, I don't think we're entirely civilised, any of us, really, you know? I mean, this is about a murder as well as everything else, you know. And when the murder happens, both the central characters are exultant in a strange way. I mean, I think civilization hadn't really had that much to do with the human condition in a strange way.
Yeah,
you know?
I think that's what I was kind of saying, which is that we're all around acting civilized, but there are these... The primal forces are still fairly powerful.
And
in
maybe
us,
the job of civilization is to keep them at bay and keep them, to manage them in some way, you know. But I think they're definitely there, and they're definitely there in the Irish character and the Irish landscape. I think, you know, any writer would tell you that, Brendan. I think, you know.
Yeah, and I think in West Cork as well, they're strong down there.
Yeah,
you have a place out in
Beara,
don't you? Which is quite.
That is
a mythic kind of.
It's a long way from everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a long way from Clonakilty, I'd say, really. And it's a long way from where Jeremy lives, you know?
Yeah.
Which is a much more civilised environment. It's full of ex-BBC producers and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But it's... one of the things I wanted to examine in this novel was the sophistication of that there is in Irish culture, you know? I mean, the thing I know about that area is the thing I... love to go to as often as I can is the Bantry Music Festival, you know. That is a really sophisticated gathering, you know. They play really austere classical music, you know. And, you know, it's, we are, you know, there is culture in Ireland. There is culture in the furthest reaches of the landscape, you know.
Mm.
And it's definitely there, you know.
You came through the younger pianist came through the kind of Fesh scene. You came through the Fesh scene as well yourself, did you?
I used to play the classical guitar when I was about 12, 13. And I used to do these little competitions in the Father Matthew Fesh.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody remembers where it was or where it is.
It's actually done by where RTE is in Cork, the Father Matthew Hall.
No, the one in Dublin.
Oh, yeah, okay,
It's somewhere off the north.
Matthew in Cork. Was there one at Fesh Matthew in Dublin as well,
Yeah. You know, little classical musicians would be kind of given grades and they'd be given cups and they'd be given little certificates and there'd be a austere group of judges listening to you and, you know, judging you and stuff like that. You know, I did that when I was a kid. But I put that into the central character I did, yeah.
Yeah. So the song you've chosen that is kind of connects to the book is Jardin sous la pluie by Debussy.
Yes, yeah.
Why?
Because it's complicated and it's beautiful and it's about a garden in the rain, basically.
Yeah.
And the central event in this book happens in a garden, in a kind of a unruly wild garden by a well in the rain.
Yeah. Okay. So here's Debussy. Debussy there, and that's a garden in the rain. Do you listen to music when you're writing, or
I can't listen to music when I write. No. Some people can. I can only concentrate on one thing. Like that piece would so distract me, I'd have to listen to it, you know, and I just wouldn't be able to even put a finger to a typewriter, you know.
As you get on now, I don't know, like, if it's true of you, but do a lot of us become maybe less social all the time and less, you know, a bit more introspective as we start getting on? Is writing a book a more satisfying thing in a way, control, introspection, rather than trying to hustle a load of people to get a movie?
Well, there's nothing as satisfying as making a movie.
Is there not?
Yeah. I mean, particularly for if you tend to be slightly overactive in your activities and you're, you know, I mean, from the moment you wake to the moment you fall asleep, every minute is, you know, it's kind of catered for, is full of kind of invention, has to be, you know.
Yeah.
Writing a book on your own is, it's, you've got to drag it out of yourself, you know. I mean, it's kind of hard work. I envy people. I'm lucky that I fell into movie making a long, long time ago, you know. I don't know if I would have been able to survive as just a novelist, you know. I'm not even talking about financially. I mean mentally and spiritually, you know. It's punishing, lonely kind of work, really.
Yeah, yeah.
It is.
Yeah. The way Banville talks about it, like, it sounds like a torturous old existence in, up in the Tower of Song in the garage
No. It's not that. I mean, it's wonderful because you're inventing an entire world and there's nobody to interfere with you. But the problem is you don't know what this animal is when you start it, you know? And you're kind of blundering in the dark, and only after about halfway through a book, with regard to this book in particular, does the book tell you what it wants to be, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay, so how does it start then? It starts as a notion or a scene or...
Well, this actually started with an old movie called Letter from an Unknown Woman by a guy called Max Ophuls. It's one of those old black and white films with Louis Jordan and... I forget who plays it. Anyway, it's about a pianist who meets a girl three or four times in their lives. She remembers everything of those meetings and he remembers nothing. You know, so it's about eroticism and egotism. And the story was bugging me for years and years, and I thought, I began to then set it in this little village in West Cork, which I invented a name for, and gradually it came together, you know. But it's, you don't know what the animal is, that's the problem, you know. You don't know whether it's a cat or a dog or a monkey or a mouse, you know, that kind of thing.
Or a hare.
Or a hare. Yeah.
So it's a wrangling kind of process.
It is, yeah. And you never know whether you succeed or not, I suppose. And if you're making a movie, you know, you've written a script, everybody has an opinion on it, everybody has an image of it, you know, and you start doing things and the cameraman says, well, I thought we were going to do this here. And you go, no, we're doing this, but maybe you're right. You know, that kind of thing. You're sharing.
Okay, yeah.
You're sharing the creation of something with but 30 or 40 people, you know, with actors and with the cinematographer and designers, you know. And that's incredibly rewarding. But, you know, it's hard to get to the point where you're making a film, you know.
So presumably having done a book and been in that fortress of solitude for a while, what the ideal thing for you now would be to get out in the world and make a movie, but you can't do that right now, can you?
There's a strike. There's the Writers Guild are on strike. The actors are on strike. The whole of Hollywood is in chaos, you know. Not that I'm part of Hollywood, really, but the whole of the independent movie business has basically closed down. You know, the kind of world I used to work in. But
due to this strike. In general, is the independent business
in general? Yeah. It's been the streaming has killed it, and that's part of what the strike is about. But the irony is that two movies came out last weekend. They're original films, and I'm talking about Oppenheimer and I'm talking about the Barbie movie, you know, which I haven't seen, but I've seen Oppenheimer. They're totally original pieces of work, you know. They're not part of it endless. They're not, you know, Fast and Furious 35 or part of the Marvel Universe or anything like that. They're original pieces of work, and the entire world is flocking to see them, you know. So there's a hunger, and there's a real hunger, I think, among people for what movies used to do, you know. But I don't know whether the powers that be in Hollywood will be able to work that particular equation out, you know.
Yeah. And like you go back to that kind of the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls kind of era, as we now think of it, where they were making films that were for grown-ups and that were hugely risky. It was essentially independent filmmakers became Hollywood in a way.
They did, yeah.
And you look at something like Oppenheimer and you think, God, actually, people still want grown-up, naughty, complicated, but big films.
They absolutely do, yeah. I mean, I'm part of a generation myself, and Jim Sheridan and, you know, probably Quentin Tarantino far more successfully, but... Steven Soderbergh, we're part of the independent influx into Hollywood. You know, it's a later generation. Yeah. It's not the Martin Scorsese and the Francis Coppola kind of thing, you know, where they actually took over. You know, they were embraced by the studios eventually. The independent kind of world existed somewhere underneath that, you know what I mean? But that little spurt of energy seems to be dying out a bit, you know.
You see, this streaming thing is an interesting one because I think initially did a lot of people feel that actually these people are giving big money to make interesting TV and interesting film that mightn't get made otherwise. But that glimmer seems to be gone a bit now.
No, the streaming thing is still there. I mean, it's very simple, really. It used to be that a film, Hollywood would make a movie, they'd release it in the cinemas, yeah. If it worked, fine. If it didn't work, they'd have the DVD sales, yeah.
Okay.
If they didn't work, they'd have a TV sale to the broadcast. So they had three shots at the at profitability, you know. Streaming killed DVD, and it's killing all those TV sales. Do you understand what I mean?
So yeah.
The only option for these studios is to make it work theatrically, which is, you can understand why they're in crisis, you know.
Because, okay. Do you see a resolve? Do you see a future here?
Yeah, I hope there. Well, the only future is in the audience. The only future is the fact that the audience wants good stuff. They want to be moved and they want to be excited in a theatre, in a cinema, you know. But I haven't got the kind of capability of working those issues out. I'm sorry, Brendan.
I'm just curious what you thought about it. So you have a film that, was it in production, the film you were doing with Neeson, or where was that at?
I was about to make a movie, yeah, but it's, you know, everything has stopped, really, you know, so either I'll return to it or not, I don't know. But, I mean, I'd actually like to make a smaller, kind of more intimate film, you know. I'd very much like to make a film of this book, actually, you know.
As I read it, I thought, he's written a film here.
I wasn't aware of that, but, I mean, I could see it as a movie. But the problem is the kind of movie that nobody wants to make anymore, you know. It's the kind of film that used to be made by Channel 4 and the BBC, or, you know, that kind of thing. Or, if you were lucky, distributed by Miramax and stuff, you know. It's what they call an independent drama. It would be if I made a movie of it, you know.
Yeah.
And those two words at the moment are kind of anathema to those people who finance movies, you know.
Yeah, there is this quote on 24 doing. They seem to be distributing a lot of interesting stuff. Is that what they're called?
A24, yeah.
Yeah,
mainly horror films, you know.
Mainly
kind of, but you know what they call intelligent genre movies, you know, or elevated horror. They call
yeah,
it.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, which like you, Midsommar,
which you have dabbled in yourself.
I've done a few of those. Yeah. I've tried.
And like there is an element of the folk horror to the book as well, that, and I think that the folk horror thing, people are kind of appreciating all of that again.
I will make this someday. I will make it. You know, maybe when all the dust clears. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, another piece of music you picked, and it's from an act called Selk. And actually, I didn't know Selk, and I've listened to that album, Shed the Skin, which is actually a really magical album. Like, I think if someone like Björk had put out that album, everyone would be raving that it was a work of genius. Okay. But one half of Selk is your daughter, Anna.
Anna. She sings and she writes. And she's an artist, you know, and I love her work, you know. She never will let me play with her. I'd love to play with her in public, but she never will let that happen. But anyway, she's quite a special talent, but you know, and she's done music for me on Breakfast on Pluto. Any score that was on that film was provided by her.
Okay.
She wrote a song for a film I did called Greta, and you know, and she's an artist who is, you know, I think pretty great, and I hope you enjoy her work.
Yeah. Would you have been disappointed if a kid of yours went to work in the bank or insurance or whatever?
I would have been so relieved, believe me. God almighty, you know. I begged them not to do what I've done, you know. But you can't help what they're going to do, you know.
No, you can't. This is Selk and Moments. This is beautiful.
Wrap myself around.
Okay, so that's Selk there and Moments. Text here, Neil. In the Company of Wolves was the first film that, as an early teen, I loved for myself. Not from going to a film with family or a film we were supposed to love. I taped it off the TV on our fairly new VCR and pretty much wore it out. It was an important part of my passage from childhood to adulthood and sexuality. It sounds like Neil's book is going to bookend a transition to an older sexuality to me. I'm looking forward to reading it. Do you think the sexuality of sexagenarians and maybe septuagenarians doesn't get enough of an outing in culture?
I'm not speaking personally, but I've been told it's possible. I'm 73 years old, you know. What am I going to do? Pretend I'm 24? You know, pretend my tastes are as they were when they were 24? The older I get, the more I like stuff that challenges me, stuff that is difficult, stuff that actually you have to wrestle with, you know. I'm talking about music, I'm talking about literature, and I'm talking about movies, you know what I mean? And so maybe, did I answer your question? I'm not sure.
Okay, no, listen, you've answered plenty. So The Well of St. Nobody is published by Bloomsbury. We'll finish up with a bit of music. Just tell me really quickly, this is from the soundtrack of The Crying Game, I Love It, doing Stand By Your Man. Do you pick the songs yourself, or is it you pick this?
I picked them, yeah. But I mean, I picked Percy Sledge, wasn't it, singing When a Man Loves a Woman at the start. I'd asked Boy George to do a version of The Crying Game by Dave Berry, which he did with the Pet Shop Boys, and we used the Dave Berry version. And there was quite a complicated soundtrack to the whole movie. But when I'd finished the film, we were just doing the dub, and I was in a chipper in Dublin with Brenda, my wife, you know, and this came on, Lyle Lovett singing, "Sometimes It's Hard to Be a Woman." And, you know, I just thought, okay, that's weird, but rather wonderful. You know, maybe let's use that for the film. Whether I said it or she said it, I don't know, but it that's the context out of which the idea came, you know.
Okay, we finish up on that. Text here, great to hear a Neil Jordan interview. Let's take care of our most creative people. Continue creative success to him. The Well of St. Nobody, as I say, published by Bloomsbury. Neil Jordan, thank you very much. I love it. Take it away.
After all, he's just a man. Stand by your man. Give him two arms to cling to and something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely. Stand by your man.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.